everyone. Thanks again for downloading this next episode of the podcast or listening to it now that we are on Spotify, which I'm really happy about. We've actually got quite a few guests lined up in the next couple of weeks, so hopefully the episodes will be coming a bit more regularly than it has been the past year. And today I'm really happy to be joined by Mercedes Jimenez-Segovia, who is at the moment working for Psi Quantum in Palo Alto as the Director of Optical Architectures. So Mercedes, thanks a lot for giving me an hour of your time.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Simon.
So as I usually do with these episodes of the podcast, I think people like to hear about the background of the people that we have on and sort of what got you into quantum computing and quantum information development and sort of the history of sort of how you came up through the educational system and ultimately how you ended up in California.
Sure. So I'm originally from Spain, and I did physics at university, at the Universidad Complutense in Madrid. And I mainly chose physics because I was very interested in how complex theories about nature could be derived from kind of very basic principles. So that attracted me a lot. And from very early on, actually, I was quite convinced that I wanted to do research. I was very lucky that I won a scholarship to do some research work on my first years of college. And I started off doing research in high energy physics. And actually my first paper is on that topic. I then went on a summer internship for a couple of summers to Imperial College, to the Control Quantum Dynamics group. And I was working there with Dr. Daniel Bergerth on some quantum control. And so I got hooked on quantum physics and quantum technologies. I thought it was one of the most fascinating theories of nature, quantum mechanics. And I thought it was very interesting how you could take this theory and actually apply it to build technology. I had always been fascinated by how technology emerges from the underlying physical principles. One thing that I remember as a child not understanding at all were how, like, I could not imagine how computers work, how I could enter through the keyboard a word and somehow that translated into zeros and ones. My father is a computer scientist, so he had told me, oh no, computers run on zeros and ones and they're just basically electrical signals. And that was something that it was always in the back of my mind, something I didn't quite understand what it goes all the way down from, you know, those signals to a like an operating system as we see every day. Mm-hmm. So it really interested me that this group was actually developing quantum technology, and I could really see the line and how it was being drawn from the theory onto the applications. So when I graduated, I went on to from Madrid, I went on to do a master's and a PhD at Imperial. And at Imperial, they had this Centers for Doctoral Training, which are one. So you do 1 year of intense courses and then you choose your project. And I remember, we had to choose our projects, and Terry Rudolph, who was one of the directors of the center, took my class. He took us to Bristol so that we could see the range of research that was being done there, because we could choose projects from other universities. And I went along, even though I never intended to be an experimentalist, or even I was not that interested in experiment at the time. But I remember going to Bristol and became completely enamored with an idea of how to build a quantum computer with linear optics. So the group in Bristol presented some ideas that they had. It was a bunch of PhD students who had been toying around with, you know, how would an architecture work, etc. So I completely loved that project, and then managed to get that project as a PhD project, working with Jeremy at Bristol, Terry Rudolph at Imperial, and also they were joined by Dan Brown at UCL. So it was really a triad of supervisors spanning the theory and experiment. And I've been basically, that has been, I almost consider it my academic life project. I've been working on that topic ever since. So after finishing my PhD at Imperial, I did a postdoc in between Bristol, working in Jeremy's group, but also as a visiting scholar in Calgary. And after that, when Jeremy, Terry, Mark Thompson, and Pete Chadwell founded PsiQuantum here in California, and they offered me a job, I was ecstatic, to say the least, to come join them.
So, would you consider yourself more of an experimentalist, or are you still very much in the theory camp?
Oh, I'm still very, very much in the theory camp, but I really enjoy understanding what the experiment will look like, and also to take into consideration the experimental constraints. So this is actually one of my main interests. I'm very interested in architectures, but I want to understand kind of the entire stack. And one of the things that really struck me while I was doing my PhD, I went to a conference on error correction. And at the time, I knew very, very little about error correction, and I knew a little bit more than that about experimental constraints from talking to the PhD students in and the postdocs, et cetera, at Bristol. And I remember going to the talks of I think it was a QEC 14, and thinking, but they were talking about IID noise and completely random Pauli, never coherent noise. And I was thinking, but that's not what noise looks like in an actual experimental systems. And now, I mean, the field has evolved a lot in recent QEC conferences. You can see how, like, the theories, like the error models, are much more in tune with actual experimental constraints. But it's always attracted me to understand what are the interfaces between all these different fields of work, because I believe that the most progress happens when we understand and figure out those interfaces, so that we can optimize for the whole problem, including all the different areas, rather than just optimize for one small thing.
So, I mean, your current title is certainly interesting because it is Director of Optical Architectures, and I've been in sort of the architecture development field for a while as well. I mean, maybe let's talk about for a little bit this sort of distinction, because you're right. I mean, a lot of us are trained in theory, a lot of us don't do much experiment, but we very much stick our feet in that pond. So, what do you see as being sort of the primary role and sort of the primary job functions of sort of like a quantum architect? What's all of this supposed to be about?
So, I think, computer architecture, when so I've done a bunch of reading on kind of classical computer architectures, and classical computer architectures are always they're defined as okay, so what are the instruction set that the machine needs to perform, and then what are the how the instruction set is implemented, and then what are the functions that are built on top of that instruction set, and how we get more and more advanced performance or advanced functions as we have, like, layers. So there's always, like, this kind of layering system, right? And so I think the primary function at the moment for quantum architects is to really understand what are those core functions, how are they, and once they're defined, like, how are they best implemented in the system. And I think what is tricky is that, depending on the so at the very hardware, like very close to the hardware level, the functions and, like, that instruction set that I was describing is really dependent on the abilities of the hardware. So there's a line at which, for example, if you already have logical qubits, then, because you have run an error correction code, et cetera, then from then onwards, well, it doesn't really matter, like, the bottom, like, how the hardware is implemented so much, because, well, once you have fault tolerance, then you just have to implement algorithms. And so, in a sense, algorithm research in the once we are in the fault tolerance regime is really, like, not that dependent on the actual hardware. Of course, it will be dependent in terms of maybe gate speed, etc. Mm-hmm. Right, but in a sense, not in the functions that they are required to perform. However, when you're very close to the hardware, it's really like the interrelation between the instruct, how do you define the instruction set as a function of what you can do, is really something that is, it goes, it's a relationship that goes both ways. You cannot really define an instruction set without knowing what you can perform and vice versa.
So in this particular case, especially when it comes to quantum architectures and systems development, I mean, I don't know if you agree, but it's a little bit more hands-on-y with the experiments, because it's not like we can yet abstract our way out from the quantum processor itself. I mean, the hardware required to actually do it, you end up having to embed yourself a lot more in it, as you know, in the same way that you might embed yourself years ago with, you know, the nitty gritty of actually fabricating CMOS chips.
Yeah, exactly. I think at the moment we are, in my opinion, in a very fascinating point, because you really like need to understand how how the functions are really performed and what are the capabilities. So I read recently a wonderful book that describes very similar, so the basically the devising of a new architecture and a completely new machine, but back in the 70s, where actually the engineers, you know, even after they came up with the architecture and the instruction set, they were literally going back to the hardware and like putting in some resistors or capacitors that were missing. It's a, the book actually won the Pulitzer Prize back in, I think, the 70s or the 80s. It's called The Soul of a New Machine by Tracy Kidder. And I think, obviously, it'll still be time until we, like, somebody writes an account of, like, how, you know, some group of people built the first quantum computer. But I have found that book, I could see in that book a lot of similarities with what the work is today for a lot of quantum engineers, quantum architects, and quantum software developers, where you're working with something that is not yet completely defined, so you're having to navigate these interfaces and establish what are the requirements at very different levels. And you're basically set, like, you're in uncharted territory. Whereas, as you say, for a lot of classical computing development, now it's so well understood that there are very clear lines where the different groups work.
So when you were doing your PhD and your first postdoc in Calgary and whatnot, so you've done most of your work in relation to optical systems, linear optics, quantum computing. Has that always been your focus, or did you dabble in other systems? I mean, what made you choose to stick with optical quantum computing versus, say, one of the other six or seven viable architectures that are being developed so far?
I am broadly interested in all quantum technology. I've done, I have a paper on quantum dots, I've read around a lot. I think that I actually have, obviously, a lot of faith in the capabilities of the linear optics system for quantum computing. Also, I believe that out of all the physical systems, is the one that has the most advantage once it comes to large scale, because, well, not only they can be manufactured with CMOS compatible, like CMOS facilities, etc. But I think once you get to the point of large quantum devices and you start thinking about networking, etc., there's really only one technology. So I think there are a lot of pros for the system. Also, to be honest, I find it personally a very elegant system to study, in which there are so many things that I have seen have improved and we've learned, and I just personally find it extremely elegant. It's also, as I say, like, it's a matter of preference, but usually as well, the thing you usually value more, the things you know the best. So I think there's a little bit of an element of that as well.
Oh, I'm sure there is. But one of the other reasons that we had you on the podcast today is you've thrown your hat into the ring on a series of books that are starting to come out now on programming quantum computers. So you have one that's currently released on Amazon, and I'll put the links to your book in the description of this episode, with co-authors Eric Johnson and Nick Haringer.
Yeah.
So let's have a bit of a summary of what this book is focused on and what you're hoping the general public get out of it.
So when we started thinking about this book, this was back in, I think, 2017. So basically, there were no books on programming for quantum computers that were aimed at non-physics PhDs. So most of the, how any of us went and learned like Shor's algorithm and what we all went to Mike and Ike's, the Nielsen Chuang book, right? And we learned them from there. And that book assumes an amount of knowledge, and it uses a certain notation that as physicists with many years of quantum mechanics and Dirac notation, etc., it seems obvious and trivial, but it's actually, it presents a huge barrier for developers that maybe they're not used to the language. And a lot of the time, we're at the point where we're starting to separate the how do I implement a gate, right? So the engineers that are building the computers need to know how do you implement the gate and what are the system requirements and what is the optimal operating point, etc. But at the other end of the spectrum, let's be honest, most of us that use the computer actually don't understand exactly the physics, the semiconductor physics that are actually running our devices. We don't need to know exactly what is a physical process that is helping us or that is implementing a particular function, as long as we can understand the function as a black box doing something. So this was kind of the premise of the book. So let's try to explain quantum algorithms in a way that is accessible to those that don't have a physics background. So the group of authors that got together, so we actually all knew each other from Bristol. We were all there together at some point. And so you all now know who I am. Nick Harrigan is, he has a PhD in quantum foundations, also with Terry. But he actually is an award-winning outreach, outreach communicator. And then EJ, Eric Johnston, so he is a programmer. He has 20 years of experience in graphics, and he was basically a representative of the target audience. He was someone who got into quantum without having a PhD in physics, etc. And actually, one of the things that gave us motivation to write this book is that EJ was at some time for some time a postdoc in Bristol, and actually one of the things that he came up with an algorithm he calls a quantum supersampling, which is a different type of algorithm than the ones that are usually computer scientists come up with. Is something for graphics, but actually what that showed is that is the type of application that it actually doesn't give you a speed up, but it actually gives you a completely different answer than the classical version would have. So actually something that you could use together with the classical supersampling for graphics to better the solution of this problem. So we kind of had this idea that a lot of the progress, so there's a lot of fundamental algorithms, the quantum Fourier transform, the Grover algorithm, etc., that maybe we're not expecting that necessarily programmers knowing nothing about quantum physics would come up with those. But they might, if they are able to understand what those primitives do and how they can be combined and how does the data have to be loaded and all these things, they might be able to apply some of these principles or these primitives to problems that it wouldn't have occurred in the physics community because, well, for example, like I knew nothing about, I still know very little about graphics, right? So it would have never occurred to apply those to a graphics problem, whereas it is the people working in those domains that actually might see the usefulness of some of the quantum algorithmic primitives that the quantum physics is know so well.
So, I mean, your book starts off and you have it very early on as sort of an example of a qubit. And given your background, it's not surprising that your example of a qubit is optics-based. But that seems to be about it in terms of sort of physical sort of manifestations of what qubits are. There's like a page and a half. And then you seem to immediately delve into sort of primitive operations and how you start building up circuits. And I assume this was very much a deliberate choice when it came to how to write the book. So what exactly motivated sort of this very simplistic step-by-step into it? Is this feedback that you guys got from the classical community? Were you looking at other examples of open source software or development platforms and tried to take the good parts and try to fix the bad parts?
So we were all very familiar with O'Reilly books and kind of like the step-by-step programming books with lots of samples, etc. Actually, like we went a lot back and forth with like, should we explain what a physical qubit is? Does anybody explain what a physical bit is when you learn to program Python? We went back and forth a lot with this. And basically we settled on only introducing things if there was a very good reason. So for example, one of the things that I found quite hard is as a physicist, I'm very used to thinking, well, you know, I have my qubit and I can measure in the X, Y, or Z basis. However, like the measurement basis is actually not essential for someone to start using or start learning some of the algorithms, right? Because after all, you can always do a rotation and then measure on the computational basis. So for example, that was one thing that like we don't explain measurement basis at all until the very last chapter. So the very last chapter we have we're calling it a staying on top guide to the literature, where basically we say, well, this is an introductory resource. A lot of the concepts that we've learned here actually are a bit more expanded or have a different notation in the academic literature, and then we explain what that is in the very last chapter. But our intention is to not introduce any concepts that are not strictly necessary in order to understand the functionality. Because when you're learning something that is completely new, you have to take into account the cognitive load of the reader as you're introducing more and more concepts. So that was what we had always in mind. You know, if we were someone who had no idea about quantum computing, is this the thing that they must need to know, or is it better that they understand some other fundamental concept in a much more deep way or much more clear way?
And when you give these examples throughout the text, I mean, you have code snippets and stuff that are available on GitHub. Did you guys write your own framework for this, or is this based on one of the other simulators or open source platforms that are generally available online?
So one of the things that we actually thought it might deter some people from getting started in quantum computing is that, so for all of the advanced development kits, you have to download and this you know, a whole setup, etc. So we thought, you know what would be interesting is if we could have a simulator that runs on the browser, like it runs on the computer browser, on the phone. EJ is extremely proud that it runs on your Kindle browser. you can actually run a very small quantum program, right? Maybe, I think, I don't know if we get to like maybe 20 qubits or something like this. Like a very small quantum program, but you can run it on the browser and you can get a feel for how it works. So some of the things that we introduce in the book is a visual notation for the state vector. So if you so for any given state, if you span the state vector in the computational basis, we represent the amplitude and phase of each of those terms in terms of a circle that has area filled in. The amount of area that is filled in is proportional to the probability of measuring that. So it's like the square of the amplitude of that term. And then there's a needle. So it's like a rotation, like a circle that can be rotated. The needle represents the phase. So this allows, and we have on the online simulator ways to color it so that you can start seeing patterns, etc., in the data. So the simulator is there to provide like a zero cost, zero effort entry for people to just start playing around with it. So in the browser, you can change the number of qubits. You know, for example, if you want to run a Grover's algorithm, you can change the number that you're inverting just or the number of iterations to see how it works. And so all the code snippets are provided in a like we call it QC engine language, which is basically it's a JavaScript-based language, extremely simple. And we did this so that the language is kind of our own. But what we've been doing is engaging with some of the the large providers of quantum languages, so that we're in the process of all the snippets in the book. They are being translated to OpenQuSM, Qiskit, Q-Sharp, etc. So that if you have already installed the Qiskit development kit or the Q-Sharp development kit, and you just want to take the code that is described in the book, that is kind of gone line by line, explain what's happening, you want to just take it and run it in those systems, we are also providing the code to do that. So our aim is to be basically platform agnostic and to provide a resource that people can use in whatever platform they prefer.
So in the book itself, I mean, do you have much of a discussion? Do you talk about it all, sort of the complexity theory ideas behind quantum as to, look, we've got these very, very powerful classical supercomputers out there. The whole idea of quantum being is that there are some problems that are just intrinsically difficult for a classical computer to solve. And so a lot of the stuff in quantum algorithm development is not just necessarily finding a quantum circuit that works to solve a specific problem. It's also about being able to analyze it and saying, look, this is also a problem that is suited for quantum.
Yeah. So we have like complexity, quantum complexity theory is a very broad topic. That is not what we try to tackle. But we have at the very end of the book kind of one section just basically talking about, problems that can be solved faster in quantum versus conventional computers. We also make this distinction in when we explain, for example, QFT, and also we explain the Grovers, etc. So there's certain points in the book where we make the point that when do you get speed up? And for example, we have a chapter in which we explain quantum machine learning, and there we discuss the issues of loading the data, etc. So we try to be we're very honest on what are the capabilities, etc. But it was not the purpose of the book to actually explain this difference. We make a point of it, but the book is basically aimed at people to get conversant and comfortable enough with all these operations such that they can start seeing some of the benefits, some of the places it might help. So for example, one of the things that that we do is after having explained Grover search and amplitude amplification, etc. So one of the, the amplitude amplification basically tells you you can use this algorithm to give a square root speed up to any NP-complete problem, right? Because any NP-complete problem you can write as a KSAT, and KSAT belongs to the class of problems to which you can apply the amplitude amplification and get a small speed up. So something that actually I found very interesting, and this is one of the things that it had never been so clear in my head as it is now. How do you build an oracle, right? So if you wanna solve a problem that can be expressed as a KSAT problem, how do you write the oracle? Because the speed up from amplitude amplification, you actually need to learn, you need to build that oracle. So we have a chapter in which we explain a way of building that oracle. And now, of course, you know, there are in a few of the samples, there can be ways of doing it faster, but the purpose is that we're trying to explain, you know, from basic principles, how you do it. And once that is settled, then like the readers themselves can come up with optimizations, etc. And so some of the feedback that we've gotten on the book is actually some of this kind of really clicks. So we have a lot of, small examples or little stories explaining. We have one on teleportation and Alice and Bob, or for example, for solving logic problems, which is basically the one using amplitude amplification and oracles, etc. We have, you know, a small story where somebody needs to solve a logic problem in one go, right? And it turns like, and we expert, like you have that example, and then we say, okay, let's take this problem that seems like completely logic, nothing to do with quantum, and let's solve it faster using a quantum processor. So, I mean, obviously that one is like a very small, I don't want to say silly, but it's like, it's kind of a fun example. However, I think it provides that connection. And one of the things that I think somebody who left us some feedback was saying that example was what kind of helped them, like it clicked in their head, the connection. So this is all that we are aiming for this book, that people can start understanding those connections and start using quantum operations in their playground, trying to try them out and use them for different things. Because I think there's a lot of progress that can happen if we have more quantum savvy engineer and developers.
So it's an interesting question, especially again, because we're talking about software development for hardware that still doesn't really exist. When you start sort of formulating how you would teach this to classical software engineers or classical computer programmers, one of the things I've always been interested in is that classical computer programmers and software engineers are somewhat spoiled these days. We've got extensive memory available. We've got extensive processing power. And so a lot of the times you can hack together something. It might not work great, but we've got enough hardware now that you can do quite a lot. Whereas in the quantum space, as you know, we're going to be very, very hardware restricted, at least initially. And then you start talking about error correction and the difficulty of applying certain gates and the constraints around optimization, what gates you don't want to use very often because, at least in an error-corrected environment, they cost a lot in terms of physical resources. How much of that discussion have you had either within the book or just, you know, amongst yourself and any classical friends you might have as to how that has to be taught to sort of this next generation of quantum computer programmers who don't have the luxury of having, you know, 10 petacubits around or 30 million quantum processors on the cloud to play with?
Yeah, so I think that's a very interesting question. That is a topic that we don't cover in the book. So at the very end, we have like a section saying, well, you know, this book is under the premise that you have a large quantum computer and that you can perform all these gates, etc. And of course, there are optimizations that you're going to want to do. There's like a whole field of compiling quantum algorithms that weigh the different costs of different gates, etc. So this is something that we did not go into in the book. So the book was just, you know, what are the quantum primitives? What is QFD? What is, you know, Grover's, etc. But I think it's actually it's a very good point. One thing that we found, so at the very beginning of the book, we make the comparison of quantum processing units, or QPUs as we call it through the book, as very similar to GPUs and how they were in the early days, right? So GPUs, when they first appeared, right, it was not clear how to program them. It was not very clear, you know, like their capabilities were very small, and the hardware was incredibly expensive, right? Mm-hmm. It didn't have the same RAM and like the, and so we actually at the very beginning of the book we do say, look, you know, this is exactly, we are at the, like, QPUs are like on those early days of GPUs where the architectures were not fixed and the hardware was not fixed and the capabilities and everything was just very different. And what we're trying to explain here is what are those basic principles that theoretically can be applied to this operation, to this processors. And we really don't go into the details of, you know, what is the cost of different operations, etc., because that would, I feel like that would be a whole other book. I mean, like I find it amazing when you take an algorithm and you actually tailor it to like a specific hardware device that you cannot make assumptions about how the underlying gates are made, right? Mm-hmm. And actually one of the things that we, in a sense, to give a little bit of a flavor of this, there's one chapter in which we say, okay, so you would write teleportation this way. And then we say, but, you know, we want to implement, so we kind of give the code for running it on one of the IBM's machines. And as well, in that case, there's actually restrictions on where you can apply CNOT gates. And then, so if you're actually programming for realistic devices, you're going to have to take all of that into account.
So in this specific case, I mean, the whole goal of not only your book, but I think the emergence of many of these software platforms, whether they're plugged into actual quantum hardware on the back end or not, mm-hmm. I've always seen a lot of these platforms, whether it's Q-Sharp or Circ or I did a count a week or so ago, there's something like 156 simulators now available for quantum computing, all with a variety of different assumptions, you know, state vector simulators, density matrix simulators, tensor contraction networks, all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It always seemed to be the goal to me was we want to, you know, physicists are not good algorithm developers. We're not mm-hmm. good software engineers. We want to get people who are out in industry, who have actual real world problems, coming in to start developing algorithms and start developing techniques for quantum computing to find sort of that small scale, commercially viable application. Mm-hmm. What's been your experience in regards to engaging that non-quantum community?
I think actually there a lot of them, the ones I have met, they're extremely curious about quantum computing, but they, like, I think, and that was part of the reason to start the book, they didn't have resources available to start this up. So I was you know, maybe I've come down from my high chair as, oh, I have a PhD in quantum physics, and like only people with PhDs in quantum physics can really understand these things. And really, I was like, my mind was open when I saw, for example, this as I mentioned, this quantum supersampling algorithm, where it's basically an application that I didn't know existed, I didn't know it was needed or useful or anything like that. And you can see how, you know, so it's basically an application of quantum sum estimation, but it can be applied to a real world problem. So I think there is a lot of potential there for people to play around and find new applications. I think there's like all the communities that are appear online, like Qiskit, and I think Q-Sharp has another one on Circ, etc. I think a lot of people learn a lot from trying things out by themselves. And I think that's one of the reasons why this kind of books and resources are really very important, to open it up to people that know what the problems are that they want solving. And of course, you know, I think there's still, it's not the equivalent to, for example, saying, oh, we're going to find a new type of algorithm similar to Grover's or the QFT, etc., right? Like, I think for coming up with those algorithms, you actually have to understand a lot more on complexity, etc. So But a lot of the applications of those fundamental principles, I think we're going to see a rise on the number of applications that are found by software developers. And actually, this is in a sense how we structure the book, in that we talk about, you know, first kind of some of the basics, right? Like one qubit, multiple qubits, stuff like this. And then we divided the book into quantum primitives, right? Which is, you know, the like those workhorse algorithms that, you know, are used to do some, like, are used to fulfill like a particular function that is maybe in itself is not like what you would not use it in itself, but it's like the, at the core. And then we have the part of quantum QPU applications, which is, okay, let's take those primitives and either combine them together or use them for certain problems. Or let's take some complex problems. So for example, in the short chapter, obviously, we take Factor and we say, okay, how can we rephrase this problem in a way that we can use a QPU primitive in order to solve it, right? So, and our hope is that people can read through this and understand it, and they can see other applications onto which they could apply this primitives.
So what do you see as more of the bottleneck? Is the bottleneck the intimidation factor of you're dealing with quantum, or is the bottleneck, look, I might spend a week or 2 weeks reading your book or other books or playing around with Qiskit or Q-sharp, but at the end of the day, your back-end simulators can maybe get to 40 qubits. Your chipsets are sitting at 20 to 30 qubits at the moment, and they're noisy. So there's just not much I can do.
Yeah. So I think a lot of the out of all the algorithms that we talk about in the book, we actually have samples of them running and showing an advantage for all applications, with exception of machine learning, which we actually would have needed a much larger simulator, mm-hmm. right? But you can start understanding, and obviously, you know, we explain that here. We're talking about, you know, clean qubits without noise, etc. Right? So, and that noise is an issue that currently needs to be taken into account for the real devices that we have available now. But I think we're at the point where there's kind of like a dual progression where there's a lot of quantum engineers and quantum architects and physicists and academics, etc., working on developing those devices, right? And there's people also thinking about the algorithms or the primitives that we can run on those devices. But I think, you know, we will see the application of primitives onto real world problems, that, and actually we'll see a lot of gain from that. So it's basically, I think about, you know, whether the people that invented or the first thought about internet could have ever imagined something like, well, social media, right? Like that's kind of like an application that came, that it didn't have, like the people who created this didn't have it at all. For example, when the first classical computers, you know, they started because we wanted to do calculations on for maritime like design, etc., right? And nobody could imagine that you would actually use them, you know, that you would substitute computers would be your communication devices, and that you would make films and write books and do things like this on such devices. So I think I have a lot of hope for the ingenuity of these communities, and what we tried to do with this book was actually provide a resource that they can use, and that it doesn't have this this high kind of activation energy or this very high threshold for getting started.
So I mean, what do you think is, you know, I don't think we've reached a critical mass of interest in order to get, you know, the vast majority of computer programmers out there interested in quantum. I mean, what do you think that will take? Do you think we need to really get to, you know, a large number of at least 1,000 qubit chipsets existing around the world? And then, you know, what is it going to take before we start seeing more of a flood?
Actually, yeah, that's a very difficult question to ask, and I'm not sure how to ask it and to answer it. I think one thing that, from talking to some hardware engineers, like sometimes I've seen them, like they will get, I know people that would buy, like that bought the, some of the first GPUs or some of the first like neural network chips, etc., simply to see how they worked and to get their heads around it and to see how they could use them. So I think at the moment, that is the vast majority of people interested in quantum from these communities. They are the people with that kind of curiosity. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, maybe there's not like, you know, millions of computer programmers that are interested at the moment. To be honest, I have no idea of the numbers. I know IBM, they have like some tremendous numbers of engagement for their platform. But what we thought when we started writing the book was that as a resource such as this one that was platform agnostic, that did not, that is straight away from the math, like this is programming, like sure, you know, you can have vectors and matrices, but actually you're talking about functions and operations. You don't need to have, you know, long sequence of Dirac notations or very complex equations. I think in the entire book we have, like with exception of the chapter on quantum machine learning, I think we only have like, I think like one equation, which is the one to calculate how many Grover iterations you need. Mm-hmm. But the point is that we saw that this resource did not exist, and we were very keen to have a shot at providing it. And I really hope that the book is useful for people and it provides an entry-level point. I think one thing that I am very confident about is that people that really want to like understand the nitty-gritty of how quantum computers work, they will then take, if they start here, they will then go on to some of the other resources in the literature. But as long as we're providing an entry point, I would be very happy.
So, I mean, a lot of this stuff is targeted towards people who, you know, maybe working in the software development industry and maybe working in various fields in classical computers. But mm-hmm. considering, especially in your formulation of the problem in the book, as you said, you've divorced it pretty much from all the underlying quantum mechanics. There's a series of rules. There's a series of structures that you can play with. Mm-hmm. I mean, is it now time to start thinking about, can we bring this down earlier and earlier into the education system? Can we start thinking about quantum computing in first year university or even last 2 years of high school?
Absolutely. I see no reason why not. People start programming younger and younger these days. And there's, as I said, this, like we don't go into what are the physics behind some of the, behind this, the operations. All that this requires is actually maybe like incredibly basic linear algebra. So even pre-college linear algebra would serve, or even like, so even just knowing what functions are and, you know, how to call variables and things like this. So these are concepts, you know, very normal from computer programming. So I see no reason why it couldn't be. So I think there's a lot of mysticism around quantum computing. And of course, once you go into the details of like how to implement like the gates and like the more complex theories, of course, there's a lot, you know, there's a lot to study there and it's very complex. But the very basic principles of some things can be explained at an earlier stage. If you're able to explain, you know, things like, I don't know, I learned in high school about atoms and energy levels and all these things. Well, you know, and you were told, look, we're not going to explain why it is, but yes, it turns out that atoms behave this way and that you're, you know, there are orbitals for electrons. And nobody ever showed me a Hamiltonian. But I, you know, this was like, okay, this is how the world works. And then if you go on and study physics, then you will understand how to derive those orbitals, etc. So this is the same kind of thing. You're introducing things and you can provide people the resources to play around and try to get an intuition, and then they can understand their lying physics. I really believe that whenever we say, oh, you know, physics is so counterintuitive. I mean, it is if you compare, like, if you've only been exposed to classical physics. But after, you know, many years of studying quantum mechanics, like a good, you know, a professor, I'm sure that quantum mechanics is, you know, it's expected that there's going to be quantum tunneling or, you know, in a quantum system, right? So there's a level of, it's not so surprising anymore, many of the things. I'm not going to say that there's no surprises, obviously. We still have a lot of things to understand. But you see what I mean? It's exposure that provides a sense of what is strange or similar or normal. So I think the more exposure that can be given to young students to new concepts that are going to help them in the long term, the better. I think, you know, in the British education system, I was very interesting to see how some complex physical concepts were brought in much earlier than the students actually had sometimes the mathematical background to learn about it. In Spain, we first learned the math and then did the physics. And yeah. So I saw this dark approach, and I think, you know, I found that students in England had a much more accurate and tuned in a perception of physics, understanding of physics. I could do the math, but I didn't have that kind of understanding of physics, and I blame the fact that I only learned the physics after I learned the math. So I think there's value in introducing concepts early on so that people can start thinking about them. If obviously put in the right way and without analogies and without you know, symbolism that is untrue. So, for example, I'm not sure if you know that Terry Rudolph has a book, Q is for Quantum, which is actually targeted at teenagers, right? And explains like quantum concepts without any of the math, right? So
yeah,
it can be explained, and then you can learn the math and you learn all the, you know, deep concepts. But I think all these concepts can be introduced to give a flavor earlier on.
Yeah, no, I agree as well. I think it should start coming earlier and earlier in education, and I think there is a formalism to actually motivate that. But on the flip side, I mean, you work at one of the startups that is ostensibly doing hardware development in quantum computing, but as I'm sure you're aware, the software startups are now vastly more plentiful than the hardware startups that exist right now. And some of these companies are doing algorithm development, some of them are doing software tools. Some of them are building software platforms that are supposed to augment hardware development. So from your position and working in a hardware company where there's a long road ahead for large-scale, viable, functional quantum computers, where do you think, say, the software community should be targeting their work? Do you like the environment as it exists now, or do you think it's too scattered? You'd be more useful if it was focused in a particular direction?
I can comment very little on the software development, mainly because I've not had time to follow it as closely as I would have liked. I think I see that at the moment a lot of the development is towards NISQ applications, and I wonder whether the fact that everybody's focused on NISQ applications actually is in a sense detrimental to the community in the long term, right? Because we still don't know whether NISQ devices are going to provide a computational speed up, and the only the computational speed up that we currently have, well, we have Shor's algorithm and we have Grover's algorithm, etc., and we have the promise of quantum chemistry simulation. But I wonder if there's a lot more low-hanging fruit that is simply still hanging because like the focus is solely on NISQ, of NISQ era algorithms.
So I suppose that leads into probably my final question as we're coming up close to the hour is what, if you could look into your, you know, crystal ball or your genie lamp, what would you hope to see in say the next 5 years? What would be like, you know, the ultimate, yes, we made it, or yes, this is vastly better than my wildest dreams if we came back and had this conversation 5 years from now?
Oh, predicting the future, if there's anything that centers, you're going to be wrong.
No, I usually ask a lot of people this and they always say, I don't want to predict the future, but you know, we're going to have a little bit of speculation in every episode.
Yeah. So I think if there's anything that I think it's important for us as a community to see is that we are entering the realm of engineering for some of these devices. Of course, there's still a lot of research and development that needs to happen, but we're now building systems. We're building large devices. We're bridging across fields. So actually what I would like to see is that the communities start cross-pollinating. So that there are people that, you know, their expertise is in hardware, but they actually go on to understand architectures and algorithms and all the way back. Because as I said at the beginning of the episode, I think the really big gains are in the interfaces. And that is one of the... Yeah, that is one of the things that I think as a community we need to see, and that it's not just let me find, you know, like a new way of doing a gate with a qubit, or like let me find a new error correcting code, or let me find like a new like algorithm that is only applicable to like some very obscure conditions of my system or something, but you know, a more holistic view of the entire system. Of the computer as something that contains hardware and it contains firmware running it and it contains software and it contains, you know, so I think as a community, this is one of the things that I would like to see. And I think one of the things that I've been very happy to see is that there's more developers and people from outside the community becoming interesting and asking questions and trying to learn things.
Wonderful. Yeah. So very quickly, just before we end the episode, aside from the book, which obviously I'll put the links to in the description of the podcast and put up on our social media accounts, is there anything else that is happening with relation to you in the next 3 or 6 months that you'd like to plug or advertise?
After having finished a book, I'm taking a little bit of a, you know, a rest, obviously on top of work.
Fair enough.
I think one of the things that, we are really, it's not quite finished yet, but like for the simulator, the online simulator that, we have for the book, we are like in the next three to six months, we basically want to have covered all the programming, the major programming languages that are out there and providing resources for people. So that's one of the things that we're going to keep working on.
Wonderful. So thanks again for giving me an hour of your time, and good luck with everything.
Thank you so much for having me, Simon.
No problem. So thanks a lot, everyone. And yes, pay attention to our social media feeds, or just keep refreshing Apple iTunes or Spotify. The next episode will come out when the next episode comes out. So thanks a lot again, everyone.